Good day, and welcome to the Presidential Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Shelby. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. This is our last call of the week, and as I mentioned yesterday, we will continue with three calls per week through May the 18th, and if the operating environment changes in a positive way, we'll consider our final meeting of 3 days for the week of June the 8th in a traditional face-to-face meeting. This time I'd ask the Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd just like to remind everyone that today's event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have any questions or need clarification, please contact Christina Master-Pasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will begin the roll call. Commissioner Bowditch.
He will be joining momentarily. Thank you.
Commissioner Clemens.
Present.
Commissioner Evans. Commissioner Frazier.
Present.
Commissioner Gaultier.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins. Commissioner Lombardo.
Here.
Commissioner McDonald.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Moody. Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Roush.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Mr. Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. Our focus this week continues to be on crime reduction, and today we're going to be discussing strategies and practices for law enforcement and technology use in crime reduction. All the commissioners should have received agendas and bios for this week and for this particular panel. We will post the testimony as soon as we receive them. Again, we appreciate your patience as we continue the work of the President's Commission. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the panel's discussion, delivery, and we will then open for questions after the witnesses have completed their testimony. Our first distinguished panelist is Chief Tom Ruoco, hope I got that right, Chief, who is the Chief of the Criminal Law Enforcement for the Texas Department of Public Safety. Chief Ruoco has extensive law enforcement experience, including an impressive career at the FBI before joining the Texas Department of Public Safety. Chief Ruoco, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, and members of the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administrative of Justice. Thank you for affording me the opportunity to speak before you this afternoon. As introduced, my name is Tom Ruoco, and I am the Chief of the Texas Department of Public Safety Criminal Investigations Division. I am also the co-chair of this commission's technology working group, and my testimony today will include some of the work and recommendations of that working group. In my written testimony, I formulated two recommendations regarding how law enforcement should respond to the changing technological environment. The first recommendation is for law enforcement agencies to employ a consistent and comprehensive framework when considering the adoption and implementation of new technologies. As you are aware, the technological ecosystem is rapidly evolving, and the expansion of communications technology makes collecting evidence much more complex than ever before. My division in the Texas Department of Public Safety conducts statewide investigations against criminal organizations involved in drug trafficking, human trafficking, illegal gang activity, and other specialized investigations such as fraud, cargo theft, human smuggling, vehicle theft, and illegal gambling. We utilize sophisticated technology and software-driven analytics to identify criminals and combat criminal activity. If we are to continue to succeed in this rapidly evolving digital technology, we must consistently consider new technology and use of data sets. Moreover, we must understand the complexities of deploying new technologies and data sets. At a minimum, one needs to consider capability and functionality implications, legislative and regulatory implications, public and law enforcement implications, financial and vendor implications, and governance and cybersecurity implications. I believe using frameworks that are general enough to be applied across a broad range of technologies, yet specific enough to ensure that agencies consider at a minimum the predictable costs and risks with the technology, provides decision makers with information they may otherwise fail to consider. Take unmanned aircraft systems or drones as an example. A law enforcement decision maker utilizing a technology framework would be asked, among all the other relevant information, to consider, is this technology currently in or approved for use by law enforcement? And if so, its implementation and use by that agency. Do current legislative authorities support use of this technology? And will the general public support use of this technology by law enforcement? Hopefully, this decision maker would have been provided with information that other police departments address these concerns when they obtained acceptance from the public and government officials by communicating the utility of the technology and its benefits for law enforcement and public safety prior to purchase and implementation of unmanned aircraft systems. The framework could also be informative when considering new potential use for technology. During the current COVID-19 pandemic, some European government agencies are utilizing unmanned aircraft systems to conduct quarantine checks and monitor social distancing policies. They are utilizing this technology to minimize their personnel's exposure to the virus. In the United States, a local, state, or federal agency considering similar use for drones who utilizes the framework prior to deployment would be made aware that residents in a certain city raise concerns for their privacy when drones equipped with loudspeakers were utilized to broadcast a pre-recorded warning message to individuals observed violating the COVID-19 social distancing policies. The second recommendation is for law enforcement agencies to employ a consistent and comprehensive framework when considering the creation or use of new data sets. Data sets may originate exclusively from within an agency through its use of productivity tools, crime statistics, or data collected from implemented technology tools, such as automated license plate readers and rapid DNA machines. Other data sets may be obtained from sources outside an agency, such as commercial advertising data and data from vehicle maintenance systems. New data sets can also be an amalgamation of both internal and external data, as in the Golden State Killer case, where law enforcement effectively leveraged forensic genealogy data originally collected by a private entity to trace people's ancestry to identify a suspect in a cold case. Now, framework questions associated with the creation and use of new data sets will flow along similar lines as those seen in dealing with new technologies. However, even in the case of well-defined, discrete data sets, it may be difficult for agencies to predict the full extent and consequences and benefits that may be associated with a new data set. New and much more sophisticated data aggregation and analysis techniques, such as artificial intelligence, may imbue new attributes and values to data not anticipated when it was first collected or obtained. For this reason, more care may be needed in setting up processes and procedures to ensure agencies return to the framework when new potential uses for a data set are discovered. In addition, since the vast majority of the data that we may be subject to a framework review will be stored, accessed, and analyzed in a digital world, it is important that well-established cybersecurity frameworks and data handling best practices are utilized to ensure the security of the new data sets. I believe the recommendations I have outlined covered two key issues that must be addressed by law enforcement in order to successfully identify and integrate new technologies and methodologies into our procedures and workflows. Law enforcement agencies at all levels of government, local, state, and federal, strive to do their best to protect citizens' well-being and property from all manners of threats and criminal activities. We can best succeed in meeting this objective by ensuring that the tools at our disposal continue to meet our needs and serve the best interests of the communities. It is important to note that the frameworks being recommended do not dictate or prescribe how 18,000 law enforcement executives will use it, but an opportunity to pick and choose what parts of the framework are relevant to their individual decision-making process. This concludes my presentation. I again thank you for allowing me to speak before the committee, and I stand by to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chief Rocco, for your informative testimony and certainly for your distinguished service to our country. Our next panelist is distinguished Oxford, Alabama Chief of Police Bill Partridge. Chief Partridge, we hope you and your Department of First Responders remain safe, especially considering the extreme storms and 23 tornadoes you've been confronted with, as well as the COVID-19 virus challenges. Chief Partridge, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Keith, and thank you to the Commission for allowing me to speak today. I want to talk to you a little bit about crime centers for smaller agencies that will create a better crime-fighting tool for regional areas of the country. What we did was we started looking at this 5 years ago, trying to figure out how we could best utilize law enforcement technology and utilize personnel to fight crime and to lower crime. One of the things that we looked at was creating a regional crime center. This crime center now consists of 28 agencies throughout the north central area of Alabama. We started this last year, and this crime center itself uses an array of different types of technology, such as license plate readers, poll cameras, trailer cameras, voice to text technologies for inmate cell phone calls and calls through the sheriff's offices, phone and computer forensics lab, video enhancement software, facial recognition, mobile lab for computer and phone forensics to respond to crime scenes, firefly gunshot detection, and ballistic analysis using the NIBIN. What we have found out that is most of the time you hear of crime centers being in major metropolitan areas. What we wanted to do was we wanted to bring these smaller departments together who can't afford on their own to be able to buy this type of technology. And what we did was we compiled this into one facility. And what we have seen over the last year, basically, of its use is we've seen dramatic decreases in crime, especially violent crime, across this region. Some of the crime that we have talked about and we have had drastic reductions in, such as homicides, home invasions, burglaries, and gun crime. By these agencies coming under one roof and working together, we have found that we have been able to share more information on a timely basis to be able to prevent crime and also to solve it. Whereas, you know, most agencies now are set up that they're not able to share information the way we would like to share information from department to department because we don't, one, have time to do that for the personnel, especially for smaller agencies. Like, for instance, in Alabama, the average size of a law enforcement agency is 10 officers or less. So you can imagine these smaller departments, they don't have the type of technology that is out there today to be able to help them fight this crime. But we have been able to put together a good concept for a regional crime center here, and I've noticed that other areas of the state are starting to do the same thing. And as those areas of the state that continue to create these regional crime centers concept, we will be able to link those together to be able to share information well across the state and hopefully the Southeast here in the future. I do believe that these crime centers are something that's going to be a very valuable tool here in the next decade to fight crime, because instead of putting money into one major metropolitan area that is only using it for that area, this regional concept brings us out to be able to bring multiple counties, multiple jurisdictions into the fold. Like I said before, we have 28 agencies inside this facility. That ranges from local, county, state, and federal agencies all partnering together to be able to work. And my recommendation to the commission is that we look at being able to find agencies through across our country that would be able to host this type of crime center, and through federal grant funding would be able to accomplish this mission to help these smaller agencies. You know, money's tight, and we know that regional grant funding is much easier to get than it is to just bring one lump sum in to one larger metropolitan area. We have found that this concept's working well, and that we hope to continue this fight against crime. We serve approximately 300,000 citizens inside this crime center, and with the commission's help, we can certainly make sure that the smaller agencies across the country are better manned and better equipped through these crime centers to help fight violent crime. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Chief Partridge, for your testimony today, and we thank you for your service. Your department will remain in our prayers as you're going to be confronted with new storms later this week. Let me note for the record, Commissioners Evans and Commissioner Hawkins have joined the call. Our next distinguished panelist is Chief Christopher Ammon, who is the Chief of the Firearms Operation Division at ATF. In his capacity, Chief Ammon oversees the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, commonly referred to as NIBIN. And this is a topic this commission has taken testimony on previously. Chief Ammon, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. It is my distinct honor and privilege to address the commission today. As introduced, my name is Christopher Ammon. I serve as the chief of the ATF Firearms Operations Division. I oversee the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, or NIBIN. I'd like to just briefly start out by pointing out that of the estimated 390 million firearms in America, most will never fall into criminal hands. We talk about crime gun intelligence. Crime gun intelligence has revolutionized our ability to zero in on the small portion that will fall into criminal hands and the violent offenders that perpetrate these crimes. Crime gun intelligence, or CGI, as we call it, is the collection and analysis of all information related to the unlawful use, possession, or transfer of these firearms. These are the details that lead investigators to individuals or groups committing acts of firearm violence or illegally diverting firearms, or both. The foundation of any crime gun intelligence program is rooted in technology, specifically NIBIN technology. The NIBIN network is a collection of digital ballistic images of cartridge cases recovered from crime scenes and recovered crime gun test fires. Briefly, want to discuss how it works. Much like fingerprints, each firearm produces unique markings on a cartridge case when fired. Technicians review images of the cartridge cases, markings, and then correlate them against the database of millions of other images in order to make associations and link shooting incidents. NIBIN has existed since around 1997 and has gone through many changes. I will be the first to say that in the past, it was a rarely used database and of 2D images. Then around 2012, things started to change when the technology improved to produce high-definition 3D images. This was a significant evolution because 3D images allowed NIBIN technicians and firearms examiners to create high-confidence correlations, what we call NIBIN leads. So suddenly what used to take months waiting on a firearms examiner to confirm a lead under a microscope now only took days, and you could get that information in the hands of the investigators. Another major development between 2012 and 2014, more departments started conducting comprehensive collection, which is the gathering of evidence from all shooting scenes regardless of the severity of the crime. This brought more evidence into the database for comparison and thus resulted in more leads, with seemingly less important crimes holding the key piece of information to solve more serious crimes. These shifts in philosophy in the NIBIN program and utilization provided the foundation for a more effective NIBIN network. Ever since, ATF has grown this program and advocated for what we call the critical steps: comprehensive collection, as I mentioned, timely entry, follow-up, and feedback. Since 2014, acquisitions are up almost 53%, and we've gone from 800 leads a year in 2014 to over 67,000 in FY19. I'd like to briefly discuss timeliness. This is another critical pillar of the program. Academic studies of shooting events linked by NIBIN show a high likelihood a shooter will engage in gun violence multiple times in a short period of time. Studies also show that shootings increase in severity. So a shooter who starts off with an unlawful discharge is likely to escalate to a homicide if not pulled off the street. Speed is the best strategy for intervention, to get the investigators good leads fast. On this note, ATF created the NIBIN National Correlation and Training Center in Huntsville, which allows us to remotely review correlations and return leads to investigators within 48 hours. The NNCTC has generated over 67,000 leads since March of 2016. ATF also created for the first time minimum standards on the program, which mandate NIBIN sites enter cartridge cases within 2 business days, conduct a correlation review within 2 business days, and distribute a lead within 24 hours. Finally, teams dedicated to exclusively following up on NIBIN leads ensure that all parts of the program are fully optimized. With this in mind, in 2016, ATF established 25 crime gun intelligence centers to serve as a clearinghouse for all intelligence related to NIBIN and other sources. Now, briefly, a recent study found that partnerships that included dedicated investigative units following up on NIBIN leads outperformed those who did not have such units. So ATF and our partners have established these units. To show how well this works, I'll turn briefly to Detroit, Michigan. Just one quick case example. Acting on leads generated by NIBIN, investigators reviewed 3 victimless shots fired calls that were linked by the program. Investigators used crime gun intelligence and other methods to identify a potential suspect known to shoot at rival gang members. The dedicated investigative team executed a search warrant at the suspect's girlfriend's home and recovered the firearm that was used in the shootings. Prosecutors then presented these NIBIN links during a detention hearing, and a judge held the suspect without bond. I'd also like to discuss several items assisting with crime gun intelligence in addition to NIBIN. The first, as the commission has heard in previous testimony, acoustic gunfire detection systems. These help cities increase evidence submissions into NIBIN, which in turn produces more leads. Automatic evidence analysis software helps investigators manage mountains of probative evidence. Social media search warrant returns, cell phone records, and other digital evidence often require analysts to spend hours generating connections. There are several promising private sector solutions to help automate this process. And then finally, new techniques to recover DNA from fired cartridge cases. Recently, the ATF National Laboratory developed a process to preserve and recover DNA profiles from fired cartridge cases while also meeting the 2-day requirement for NIBIN entry. Any laboratory can easily adapt this process into their current workflow and show results. For example, in San Francisco, DNA recovered from 18 fired cartridge cases led to the identification and arrest of 2 murder suspects who were also connected by NIBIN to additional shootings. With all this in mind, I would like to provide the following recommendations to the committee for helping to expand this innovative approach that has proven results. First and foremost, all U.S. law enforcement agencies must participate in NIBIN. Success requires participation by all. When one jurisdiction participates but a neighboring jurisdiction does not, valuable leads disappear. Second, law enforcement agencies should mandate collection of all fired cartridge cases and test fires from all recovered firearms. This, again, is the principle of comprehensive collection. ATF and law enforcement agencies should work together to establish dedicated investigative assets targeting violence. Shooters know no jurisdictional bounds, neither should law enforcement. When NIBIN sites join, lead agencies should establish a plan to implement minimum required operating standards prior to launching the technology. We should utilize ATF's DNA tool to solve violent crime through grants to state and local laboratories to add more scientists, grow facilities footprint, and fund additional DNA instruments. Additionally, we should expand our federal laboratories to meet the need for the federal caseload. And then finally, invest in software for investigators that help to aggregate and analyze different crime gun intelligence sources. With that, that ends my recommendations, and I'd like to thank everyone, the Commission, for the opportunity to address the Commission. I'm happy to take any follow-up questions or provide any documentation as needed. For more information on these programs, you can visit ATF's homepage for fact sheets, as well as the Bureau of Justice Assistance, who has a copy of our Crime Gun Intelligence Best Practices Guide posted on their website. Again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Chief Ammon, for your valued testimony and certainly your service to our country. Our last panelist is Deputy Chief David LaValle from the Detroit, Michigan Police Department. We know that the Detroit Police Department has been hit particularly hard with the COVID-19. We were saddened to learn that your department tragically lost a veteran captain, 911 operator, to the virus just a few weeks ago. And we were also advised that Chief Craig has tested positive and joining more than 500 officers being quarantined with 114 civilians and officers testing positive for the virus. Chief LaValle, please know that this commission will keep you and the Detroit Police Department in our thoughts and prayers. Chief LaValle, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
All right. Thank you. And thank you to the commission for the opportunity to speak today. My name is David LaValle. I'm the Assistant Chief of the Detroit Police Department. The purpose of my testimony today is to provide an overview of a program that was started by the Detroit Police Department 4 years ago called Project Greenlight Detroit that involves the use of technology to reduce crime. I also want to talk about a few technology programs that we implemented to complement Project Greenlight, describe how we use the technology, and provide some recommendations based on our lessons learned. First, I'll give an overview of Project Greenlight Detroit. During regular crime briefings in 2015, we repeatedly saw carjackings and robberies that were occurring at gas stations and liquor stores. We started asking ourselves how we could create safe places throughout the city. Out of this question came the idea for Project Greenlight. How the program works is that we partner with businesses who agree to make certain improvements to their sites at their own expense. These include the installation of at least 4 high-definition cameras at their locations that are positioned at entry and exit points and parking lots. They also improve lighting, install signage that they are a participating business, and install a flashing green light alerting anyone passing by that they are a Project Greenlight location. The business owners also agree and provide at their own expense increased internet capabilities and 30 days worth of cloud storage for the video footage, which is capable of being viewed remotely by the police department. The police department agrees to virtually patrol the locations from our real-time crime center, provide priority response both virtually and in person to calls at the locations, make special attention visits to the sites, and advertise the program, which increases awareness. The program started with 8 gas stations and now consists of 699 participating businesses and is still growing every day. This gives us access to over 2,800 live high-definition camera feeds. We have found this program quite successful as a deterrent to committing crime. At the 8 original locations, they have seen a reduction in violent crime of 44.9% comparing 2015 to 2019. All gas stations in the program have seen a reduction of 25.3% during that time, while the entire city has seen a 16% reduction during that time. And the original problem we were trying to solve for was robberies and carjacking. During 2015, we had 3,648 robberies and 523 carjackings. In 2019, we reduced that to 2,377 robberies and 244 carjackings. Still too many, but 35% fewer robberies and 54% fewer carjackings than before. Another benefit of the program is the availability of high-definition camera footage when a crime does occur. Detectives have immediate access to 30 days' worth of footage, which they are able to use to ensure case closures. We've had much success using this footage with other technology or by simply pushing it out to local media asking for the public's tips. Another program we've adopted are license plate readers. License plate readers consist of deploying high-speed cameras throughout the city that capture every license plate that passes them, recording certain data such as the date, time, and exact location, as well as taking a photograph of the vehicle. We have these mounted stationary throughout the city, mounted to police vehicles, and on mobile trailers that we can move around as needed. These LPRs are valuable in that we are able to automatically compare the license plates that pass them to lists of wanted vehicles, so that officers can make immediate stops and arrests. They also provide tremendous value to detectives, allowing them to use this as evidence that a particular vehicle was at or near the location of a crime. Another piece of technology that we added was facial recognition software. When we first implemented this technology, we faced a tremendous amount of criticism and pushback from some members of the community. There were a lot of misconceptions about how we were using the technology, most notably is the idea that we were running facial recognition on live stream camera feeds, which is absolutely not true. With our facial recognition program, we have strict policies that dictate the instances and manner in which it can be used. The bottom line is that we can only use facial recognition on a probe image of a suspect we have reason to believe has committed a violent offense, such as murder, robbery, rape, or aggravated assault. Important to note that facial rec matches are just investigative leads, and detectives still have to conduct their investigation to establish probable cause before an arrest can be made. No arrests are made or warrants issued based solely on facial recognition. I'd like to provide an example of how these pieces of technology all come together. Recently, we had a robbery and a shooting at a gas station. The image of the suspect was captured on green light footage cameras, as well as a vehicle that fled the scene. Analysts used facial recognition to develop a lead on the suspect. They then checked that suspect's social media pages and discovered a vehicle matching the description of the getaway vehicle. They then used the license plate readers to confirm that the vehicle was in the area of the crime. The victim later picked the suspect out. He was arrested and convicted. So in this instance, all three pieces of technology were critical to solving the case. Examples like that go on and on. I'd like to make some recommendations based on some of the lessons learned in acquiring and using this and several other pieces of technology we have in place. First is to invest in technology infrastructure. Having a robust technology infrastructure is critical. We need to have grant opportunities geared toward getting fiber or wireless backhaul at immense speeds, which can be very costly and prevent municipalities from taking on new technology projects. Second is to encourage transparency. As we saw with our facial rec program, transparency was key to success. We opened our intelligence center up for tours to the community and elected officials, and we provide regular reports on the use of technology to the Board of Police Commissioners at public meetings. We found it's easier to be open and transparent about how we use this technology rather than have someone else tell the story for us. Third would be to mandate training and certifications. So behind all technology, there are people that operate and use it. The fact that we had a diverse group of well-trained analysts using our facial rec system helped us considerably in gaining approval. Mandating universal certifications and training will protect both law enforcement agencies and the public from misuse. Third is to increase technical assistance. We spent a considerable amount of time and money researching what worked best. We traveled the country to learn best practices. Facilitating technical assistance and peer exchanges with other law enforcement agencies would be useful. And lastly, would be to keep CJIS up to date with current technology. The Criminal Justice Information Systems, CJIS, has many requirements for how law enforcement data is stored and shared, which is fine. But a problem we routinely encounter is that new technology has advanced beyond CJIS. An example is that almost all new technology is moving toward cloud-based data storage, which is currently a violation of CJIS. So I want to thank you again for the time allocated to me today. If there are any questions or further information is needed, myself and the entire team from the Detroit Police Department are available. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief DeValle, for your valued testimony and certainly your distinguished service. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist. If you have a question or if the response is from the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, and now we'll entertain questions from commissioners. Questions from commissioners.
Hey, Phil, this is Don Washington. I have a question for Chief Partridge.
Yes, Commissioner, yes, you're recognized.
Chief, great presentation, a great idea. I'm just wondering, how did you initially fund the processes that you had to go through and getting the buildings and all that stuff pulled together for your regional crime center?
Yes, sir. We started this project approximately 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago. And, of course, we were looking for funding during that time, and we had no luck with federal grants. So we were very fortunate that our mayor and city council stepped up to the plate and paid for the center itself. The center, like I said, houses 28 agencies. We do not ask any agency who are participants in this facility to pay anything. The only thing that we ask is that they partner with us and that they supply someone either full-time or part-time or whatever time that they can possibly have someone come into the center and work. We have several full-time individuals, but we have a lot of part-time agencies who come in part-time.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions?
Yes, this is Regina Lombardo at ATF. Mainly, a follow-up with that question that Director Washington asked. Just on that, I commend you for the focusing on some of the smaller police departments in the rural areas. Is that is probably our biggest challenge is trying to also provide that service to departments that might not necessarily have the resources or the volume to purchase the NIBIN equipment and have the technical resources and training and all that goes into it. And we often get that phone call from many police departments on, can I bring the evidence or the shell casings or this firearm to be tested and correlated? So I love the recommendation. I like the fact that it's used for several different law enforcement organizations because not everyone has a major police department like your Chicago police or even mid-sized police department. So that is a direction that I'm trying to focus on. So I appreciate you highlighting that, and thank you for your testimony today. And Chris, thank you for representing ATF.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions?
This is John Samaniego. My question is for Chief Partridge. Bill, continue to do an outstanding job there in East Alabama. You've pulling 28 agents, small agencies together was some feat, and I applaud you for it. Other than the Metro Crime Center in Birmingham and yours in East Alabama, do you know of any others that are on the forefront in Alabama or adjoining states?
Yes, Sheriff. Thank you. Chief McMurray in Huntsville is in the process of building out the North Alabama Metro Area Crime Center, and I believe Tuscaloosa is in the process of obtaining funding to start their crime center over in Tuscaloosa.
Outstanding. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Other questions from commissioners? One more time, questions from commissioners. Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and your most valued testimony and the responses to the questions from our commissioner. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership staff, Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita, and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in the deliberations and work that they conduct. Before we close, just a reminder that we'll be sending out our weekly summary to all the commissioners, along with next week's schedule of panels. We'll be wrapping up the crime reduction panel. We'll have a panel on victim services, and then we'll start with the first panel on reentry. Commissioners will receive separate calendar invites with testimony as soon as we receive the testimony. And also a reminder to the commissioners to check the President's Commission page for updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. We'll update it regularly with information as it becomes available. Any comments or questions from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, Commissioners, for your dedication and commitment. Have a great weekend, and please be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.